What we're going to be looking at this evening, we're going to begin by taking a look, reviewing actually, some of the information which I covered towards the end of the broadcast last week, namely going over something that would appear to be preposterous or fictional to the average observer, namely the activities of what amounted to a Nazi party in exile in Madrid, Spain, its activities in, around the world, but in particular its activities in Germany, and its very profound and decisive connections with the Adenauer government and with all facets of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. After discussing the underground Nazi party, the Nazi party in exile in Madrid, something that was foreshadowed in a book by Kurt Ries called The Nazis Go Underground, and something which chillingly was fulfilled, as evidenced by information that came out almost 9 years later, actually almost 10 years later, in 1953, information from, among other papers, the London Times, the New York Times, the Frankfurter Rundschau, the Stuttgarter Nachrichten, and all of this reported in a book from 1961 called The New Germany and the Old Nazis, indicates that, in fact, the Nazi contingency plans, the Third Reich contingency plans to go underground and survive their defeat, were only too successful. After taking a look at the Nazi party in exile, how it functioned by way of review, and taking a look at the coup group of Dr. Werner Naumann, a former official of Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry, we're going to take a look at the profound effect that that group had on the makeup of the Adenauer government, the first government of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. We're going to go through the various ministers which the Adenauer government had in controlling positions, and we're also going to take a look at the people who served under them. The information in the first part of the broadcast will speak for itself. There's an old expression from poker, read 'em and weep, and I think when you hear the information that I present this evening, and when you hear the information that I present the next week or two, I think that phrase will come to mind, read 'em and weep. We're going to take a look at the profound, again, the profound and decisive role of Third Reich emigre, Third Reich alumni, I should say, in the Adenauer government. They were present at all levels and in decisive ways. And one of the things that is difficult for people to understand is something that Hitler understood only too well, namely the big lie. Hitler said that the bigger the lie is, the easier it will be believed. That is one of the things that will make an awful lot of what I have to say this evening in the next couple of weeks very, very difficult for people to believe, simply because they have not been told this before, and it will consequently be rejected by a considerable number of people who will perhaps echo the American character in the radio play The High Command from 1944 that I played in the third installment of RFA 37 way, way back on August 9th. Of 1992. By the way, for the benefit of people who are listening on tape, it is today, September 27th, 1992, and we're going to be going for another couple of weeks. We're going to take a look again at the very decisive, the profound role of Third Reich alumni at all levels of the Adenauer government. After that, we're going to move from the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis to a book called Hitler's Justice, this by a German law professor and a former official named Ingo Müller. And by the way, this particular book was a bestseller in Germany. And this concerns the first part of Hitler's Justice that I'm going to be dealing with, concerns the reinstitution of the entire Third Reich civil service. After having looked at the government officials proper, both head ministers and underlings, and how many of them were Third Reich alumni, we're going to take a look at something which is equally terrifying, namely the complete reinstitution of the Third Reich civil service. That was instituted by the Bundestag's law of Article 131, and right after that came Article 132, which barred from participation in the new Germany's civil service, the quote, new, unquote, Germany's civil service, all of those who had been barred from entering the civil service between 1933 and 1945, namely those people who had been racially impure, according to the Third Reich's racial doctrines. Basically, Article 131 reinstated the Third Reich civil service. Article 132 forbade anyone who had been an enemy of the Reich or barred from the civil service because of, quote, racial, unquote, reasons, from taking part in the civil service of the new Germany. And then we're going to take a look at an addendum II, Article 131, passed a number of years later, which granted full pensions to SS people, people who had served in the SS during the war, and the partial reinstitution of the SS in the new German army. We're going to take a look at that next week, the formation of the German army. After that, we're going to take a look at the reinstitution of the Nazi judiciary in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. We're going to take a look at a list of jurists that served in important capacities in Nazi Germany and then were installed in similar capacities in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. This material will come from the New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens. And after that, we're going to take a look at considerable length at the not only the reinstitution of the Third Reich's judiciary in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, but the very important and decisive role that that played in shaping the legal structure of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. Now, I want to reiterate something that I mentioned last week, and I will repeat this both this week and next. This is not to say that all Germans are Nazis. It is, however, to say that the institutions of the Third Reich were put back in place in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, and that this has had a profound effect not only on Germany, but as we are looking at how the U.S. lost the Second World War, and in examining the society on whose behalf the Galen Organization was working, it is worth examining the very nature of that society and there is no feature of a society that is more important than examining its judicial system. We're going to take a look, first of all, at how the occupation government in Germany that was run by the United States and Britain was simply incapable of reforming a judicial structure in Germany without putting back some of the Third Reich's, in fact, most of the Third Reich's judges. The vast majority of them were. Then we're going to take a look at the law for the protection of German blood and German honor. It was this law which was passed and which served as the basis for all of the Nazis' excesses, their extermination programs, their racial purity laws. Recall that one of the things we looked at a couple of weeks ago, in reprising information from Radio Free America number 2, is that Hans Globke, the first Secretary of State of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, the power behind the throne of Konrad Adenauer, so to speak, had been the co-author of the Law for the Protection of German Blood. He was described by many knowledgeable observers as the single most powerful individual in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. He also was the individual directly responsible for administering the affairs of the Galen Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit, which we took in at the end of World War II, and which then served as, first of all, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, the de facto NATO intelligence organization. It also functioned as the West German intelligence service, while at the same time continuing to provide both the U.S. and NATO with the vast bulk of their intelligence on the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. We're going to take a look at the reinstitution in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany of many of the key jurists, the key judges who had been involved in administering the law for the protection of the German blood drawn up by Hans Globke. We're also going to take a look at some of the individuals who had served on both the special courts and the people's courts in the Third Reich. To make a long story short, I'm not going to go into the details about those courts. Both of those were special courts set up by the Third Reich. They were basically kangaroo courts, and their goal, and it was very effectively achieved, was to expedite the political or physical elimination of people who were deemed to be enemies of the Third Reich. We're going to take a look, too, at the institution, at the appointment of judges who had been involved with the Third Reich to pass judgment on cases that, in many cases, they had already ruled on during the Third Reich. Claims by victims of the survivors of Nazi atrocities, and many of these same judges sat on panels that were to review the judicial decisions of the Third Reich, and not surprisingly, they were less than vigorous in their administration of those responsibilities. We're going to take a look also at how the reinstitution of for all intents and purposes, the entire Nazi judiciary had a profound effect, not surprisingly, on the development of German law in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. Specifically, we're going to take a look at a judge named Paul-Heinz Baldus, B-A-L-D-U-S, and some of the decisions that he made, and we're going to begin making a leap to the new Germany, quote, new, unquote, Germany. We're going to take a look at how Baldus and others, as well as the Bundestag, the German parliament, basically reinstituted most of the Third Reich's laws concerning crimes against the state. Basically, even nonviolent protest was made a crime against the state. And as we jump to the, quote, new, unquote, Germany and its legal system, we're going to take a look at how treason against the Federal Republic of Germany was defined in the precise wording, quoted word for word, from the Third Reich's law on treason against the state. And not surprisingly, again, many of the judges involved in, and many of the officials involved in reinstituting many of the Third Reich's legal statutes, including the Third Reich statute concerning treason. Many of those judges were and officials were precisely the same people. And again, it's worth noting that the criminal statutes of the Third Reich, to a staggering degree, were simply put back into power, not the law for the protection of the German blood, although that was never overturned, but the basic law of the Third Reich concerning treason to the state was not only reinstituted, but in the reinstitution, in its reinstitution, it was quoted verbatim and by some of the same people involved in drawing it up the first time around. The last thing we're going to look at in tonight's broadcast concerns a 1985 decision, lest people think that we're talking about things that happened too long ago. In 1985, we're going to take a look at a move that came up before the Bundestag to repudiate the verdicts that were passed by the Nazi judiciary during the Third Reich. We're going to take a look at the move to repudiate those and how that was defeated and how the legal decisions of the Third Reich ultimately achieved the status of permanent German law in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. Recall that in Radio Free America number 2, we took a look at a 1981 decision in which the Reichstag verdict, the Reichstag fire verdict, I should say, was made was given the status of unchallengeable German law. That is what we have on tap for this evening. And again, next week we will be taking a look at the German National Security Establishment, not only the Gehlen Organization, but its role in helping to spawn the, quote, new, unquote, German General Staff, by way of taking a look at the institutions which were deeply intersected with American national security and political culture. And next week we're going to begin swinging back to this side of the Atlantic. And again, I think the information that you'll be hearing this evening and next week will appear shocking because it is new, for or will appear new to many people. It's one of the reasons why I use the format I use on this program. I read directly from the documentary sources, carefully annotate them so that people can tape them and study them, because when you are approaching an intellectual concept which is dramatically different from what people are accustomed to thinking or what people have grown accustomed to regarding, it seems to me it's incumbent to present the documentation for the events that I'm talking about. In RFA 37 is unfortunately only too reliable. Still, though, this is going to appear shocking to many and frightening to many. Perhaps the theme of the next two RFA 37 installments could be the old poker phrase, read 'em and weep, baby. Read 'em and weep. We're going to be taking a musical break, and then we are going to come back with the main body of tonight's program.